Airplane Intel Podcast, Episode 25. This week, we're back to Piston Twins, comparing the Piper PA-30 Twin Comanche to the Piper PA-34 Seneca, thanks to a listener request. Then we talk about an update to Mandatory Service Bulletin 05-8B and where to find the latest ADS-B out map from the FAA, plus aircraft ownership news, the tip of the week, and a ton of your feedback about experimental aircraft.
Welcome to the Airplane Intel Podcast, the show for aircraft owners, pilots, and mechanics. It's our goal to save you money and make your flying safer so you can get the most out of your airplane. Featuring the pre-buy guys with over 60 years combined experience flying, maintaining, and managing all types of aircraft. We will share practical advice, strategies, and tips to help make aircraft ownership simple, safe, and cost-effective. So stay tuned.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Airplane Intel Podcast, the weekly aviation podcast that focuses on the ins and outs of aircraft ownership. It's our goal to make owning an airplane more accessible and affordable by helping you save money, increase safety, and reduce risk with your personal or business aircraft. I'm Adam, and I'm joined by my co-host, Don. Hey, Don, how's it going today?
Hey, hello, welcome back. We missed talking to you aviators last week. Every week we zero in on a different type of airplane. Airplane single engine lands, and then an airplane multi-engine land, then turboprop airplane. And then at the end of the month, or whenever it comes up on the cycle, every fourth show we get into corporate jets or private jets. The most popular so far in our corporate jets is Ken's Citation CJ jet with winglets, so that was very popular. Yeah, actually, Ken gave us a few different tours of his airplane, also the cockpit tour, and he spoke a little bit about us, and we're flattered about that. Yeah. So this week, by popular request, we will present to you a multi-engine airplane, two of them. One's called a Twin Comanche, and the other one is also a Piper. It's a Piper Seneca. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the Piper Seneca in an after show. So if you're interested in the Piper Seneca after the show, don't hang up. Stay tuned, because I'm going to get a little deeper into the Piper Seneca. A couple things that I observed flying it over 1,000 hours.
Well, then I'm sure that's going to be really interesting. So you guys are going to want to stick around for that for sure. Now, guys, we took a little break 2 weeks ago, and then we missed last week, and that's my fault, really. Just we've been so swamped trying to get caught up on some other projects. But you know what? Now we're back in full swing, and we do appreciate your patience in the meantime. Now, you may have noticed that our intro music sounds a little different, and that's because we made some changes. Our friend Dean Showalter over at the Airplane Owner Maintenance Podcast put me in touch with his daughter, Mackenzie, who was nice enough to give our podcast a much-needed makeover, and I think she did a fantastic job with our new voiceover, and we are very grateful for her help on that. And actually, I highly recommend her if you need any type of voiceover work or voice talent of any kind. She did a great job for us. And so thank you again, Mackenzie and Dean. We really do appreciate it. Now, in upcoming episodes, we're going to be talking about a lot of different airplanes thanks to your requests, as well as a number of topics related to aircraft ownership. We've really been enjoying hearing from you guys lately. So if you'd like to share your stories, send your questions, or tell us about aircraft and topics you'd like for us to cover, head on over to airplaneintelpodcast.com to find out how to get a hold of us. We have all different methods, including this cool voice message feature on the homepage that you can use, and you can also hit the button that says send your questions and feedback. And while you're there, you can also check out all of our past episodes and view the show notes to this episode, number 25. Also, while you're there, you'll find out all the ways to support our show, including how to become a member of our Patreon community. And speaking of Patreon, we've got a new patron at the associate producer level. We welcome Evan Donahue as our latest patron. So welcome aboard, Evan, and thank you for your contribution. We really do appreciate it. And in our Patreon community, we do post a bunch of bonus content and uncut audio, and you also get early access to the show and all kinds of great things like that. So check that out if you get a chance. That is also on the show notes for this page. Well, we've got a lot to cover today, so let's get right to it. And our first bit of news comes to us from AvWeb, and as usual, they're doing a great job covering AirVenture 2017 in Oshkosh. And one of the most significant things that I've seen so far is two retrofit autopilot options from Garmin. The first is the GFC 500 for pilots on a budget. Priced at $6,995, the GFC 500 is an entry-level autopilot based around the G5 electronic flight instrument system that we've mentioned in the past. The G5 provides heading, pitch, and airspeed indications and vertical speed with autopilot mode enunciations and flight director command bars. Now, the GFC 500 mode selector can be easily mounted into your existing radio stack and includes a heading knob, altitude pre-select knob, and a vertical speed wheel. There is also an indicated airspeed mode, a nav mode, approach mode, and a VNAV mode, and even an envelope protection with a level button that will level the wings in case the airplane gets away from you. The control servos for the GFC 500 utilize brushless DC motors and gear trains, so there's no need for mechanical clutches, ultimately saving you money on installation costs. The STC for the Cessna 172 is expected to be approved by the fourth quarter of this year, with additional STCs for the 182 and Piper PA-28 line shortly after. The out-the-door price for the GFC 500 with the G5 EFIS system should be less than $10,000 before installation. The second retrofit autopilot from Garmin is the G600, which starts at $20,000 and is an all-new design that meets FAA TSO standards and is aimed at higher performance piston singles and twins, as well as some turboprops. It's already STC'd on the Baron and A36 Bonanzas, and it could be used as a standalone system or interfaced with a Garmin G500 or 600 PFD MFD EFIS system, as well as the Aspen Evolution. The mode controller can easily mount in your airplane's radio stack and features a flight director and yaw damper button, as well as nav, VNAV, approach, back course, indicated airspeed, and vertical speed modes with a vertical speed wheel. And of course, as with all Garmin autopilots, a level button, which I mentioned a minute ago. The 3-axis system has the yaw dampener control as an option. Now, the GFC 600 also uses brushless DC servos, so you'll save money on installation without the need for a slip clutch. And if connected to the GTN 650-750 navigators, the autopilot's go-around mode will help you fly a missed approach procedure complete with flight director command bars. Don, did you have some news for us as well?
Well, Adam, I have some news about the plane partnership program, the PPP. We have a new subscriber. He's in New Jersey and a well-qualified person. He's got an airline transport rating and all kinds of ratings. And he's typed on turboprop too. And this gentleman, he's looking for a partner. He'd like to get a Cessna 310. Yep, but he'd like to share it with somebody. So if you're in the New Jersey, kind of towards the coast, north of Lakeland, New Jersey, south of Linden, and not too far of a drive from the population center of the suburbs of New Jersey, and so if you want to get involved in a twin-engine airplane, I'm sure this fella would be happy to be your partner and teach you a lot about airplanes. Also, we have, right now, my goodness, we have so many people. We got people in Arizona and Florida, a couple of people in Florida, Georgia, Missouri, and North Carolina, Nevada, and Texas, and Western New York State, well, in the middle of New York State. They're all looking for partners, so feel free to submit that free application, and we'll put you in our data bank, and when we get a match, we'll try to get you together.
Yeah, that's right, Don, and actually we have another new member in the San Francisco area who is interested in finding a partner for a later model Cirrus SR22 or Cessna T182T. So our database is definitely growing by the day, and if you're interested in finding a partner to help make aircraft ownership easier by sharing costs and responsibilities, head on over to planepartnership.com where you'll get all the details and be able to fill out that short questionnaire. Now, our next bit of news comes to us from the AOPA. Now, a couple months back, we told you about a mandatory service bulletin from Continental that applied to Continental 520 and 550 and a few 470 engines that was likely to become an AD from the FAA, requiring owners of affected engines to perform visual inspections on older style camshafts at every annual and 100-hour inspection, with a mandatory replacement of the camshaft during the next overhaul. Now, this would be an alarming and undoubtedly expensive undertaking for owners with affected engines, so a number of groups came together to repeal this decision, among others arguing that the mandatory service bulletin does not meet the criteria for an unsafe condition, citing that only one camshaft failure has occurred in the past 53 years. Now, after further discussion and debate, TCM has downgraded this mandatory service bulletin to a non-mandatory critical service bulletin, or CSB for short. Now, this means the FAA will not be issuing an AD, and while it might be a good idea to have the cam visually inspected at your next annual, you are not required to perform a repetitive inspection, nor are you required to replace the cam at your next overhaul. Obviously, this is great news for you if you are an owner of a Continental 520, 550, or 470 engine. Now, if you have any questions about this matter, shoot us an email and we'll be glad to help. And of course, there's a link to this article in our show notes. Also in the news, I've posted on our social media pages where you can find the latest ADS-B map from the FAA. Obviously, you're going to want to see whether the areas you regularly fly in and out of require ADS-B, so you can find that on our Facebook and Twitter pages, both at PreBuyGuys. That's at PreBuyGuys, all one word. So, Don, what else you have for us in the news today?
Well, let's talk about privatization of the air traffic control system. No, we don't want any part of that. And I did mention in the past that Max Trescott, Aviation News podcast, he had an excellent two-hour-long program about what's involved there. Of course, I found the last hour very informative. So we'll put another link to that in case you missed it a few episodes ago. But what's new? Well, the Congressional Budget Office has just scored it this week, and they say it's going to cost more to be privatized. So there's a good sign. Well, I contacted my local representatives in Washington too, and unfortunately, when I called in, the secretary's answering didn't know what I was talking about. So that was a bad sign, because that means a lot of people haven't been calling in. And then the emails I dropped them, I just got one response. And that Republican, it seemed to be, well, you know, maybe privatization's a good idea. So that wasn't helpful. So what can you do? What you can do is go on the AOPA.org site, and they have a link, and also the EAA.org site also, and you put your serial, your zip code number in, and they tell you who your representatives are in Washington. And please go ahead and email them and give them a call. Tell them you're against privatization. So hopefully it won't go through. And they use an example of Canada as what a good deal it'll be. If it goes through, the Canadian general aviation pilots are only paying $65 a year for all the services. But then what they don't tell you, in Canada, the aviation department in Canada makes all their money from the Atlantic routes going over the Canadian airspace for 1,000 miles, and they charge by the mile. So they're getting all their money from the airline traffic, because that's the North Atlantic route, the most preferred route, and it covers, they cover that for a long way, where other airplanes, you know, coming around in a less efficient route, you know, to the United States on the East Coast and the West Coast, they're not in our air traffic control that long, so we don't make much money off of them. So Canada has all this money from the airline traffics on the North Atlantic routes. They charge them by the mile, and that supports their whole airport infrastructure and general aviation traffic, and they still charge $65 a year. But we don't think that's going to happen in the U.S. So please, this is the last week. Go ahead, call them up, call your representative in Washington, and drop them an email. If you have multiple email accounts, drop them a few emails and tell them you're against privatization. And I'm thanking you in advance for that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been talking about this a lot lately. And I think as of right now, the bill is in the Senate, but they've decided not to do anything with it for a little while, maybe as late as September. So I guess that means we have some more time to share our thoughts and fight against this bill. It's HR 2997. And we put a link to Max's podcast, the Aviation News Talk podcast, about privatization in the show notes, along with the latest AOPA live video that goes into some detail about it, and links to the EAA and AOPA site where you can take a stand against ATC privatization. Just head over to airplaneintelpodcast.com and click on the link for episode 25. Well, that's all for the news, so let's get to today's airplanes. If you're looking for a reliable piston twin that is suitable for both business and personal travel, Piper has you covered with its line of light twins. Today we're focusing on the PA-30 Twin Comanche and the PA-34 Seneca. Now, these two airplanes aren't typically compared side by side. About the only thing they have in common are two engines. However, some of you out there wanted to learn more about both of these airplanes, and rightfully so, because each has distinct pros and cons. And it's not uncommon for someone in the light twin market to consider both aircraft at some point through the process of researching prospective aircraft. So let's start with the Twin Comanche. It's a 4-to-6-place light twin designed to replace the Piper Apache line. The Twin Comanche first flew in 1963 with about 2,200 produced until production stopped in 1972. As you might have guessed, the Twin Comanche is a twin-engine version of Piper's popular single-engine aircraft, the PA-24 Comanche, which we covered in episode 20 with Dean Showalter. The Twin Comanche was first designated the PA-30 with several variants that eventually led to the PA-39 Twin Comanche CR. The CR stands for counter-rotating, which means the props spin in opposite directions. More on that later. The Twin Comanche really isn't a direct competitor with the Seneca. It's more in line with the Beech Trevelyan and the Grumman GA7 Cougar. Later models competed more with the Cessna 310 and the early Barons. The original PA-30 Twin Comanche was equipped with two fuel-injected IO320 B1A engines, producing about 160 horsepower per side with a 2,000-hour TBO. These are four-cylinder horizontally opposed direct-drive engines, and as most of you know, the 320 series are known for the reliability and relatively low maintenance costs. But surprisingly, the fuel-injected versions bring a lot of performance with them, somewhere in the neighborhood of 170 knots, burning about 17 gallons per hour. The original aircraft is also a four-place aircraft and can be easily distinguished from the later models thanks to its two side windows. Believe it or not, the earlier models produced from 1963 through 65 were available as barebone VFR day only aircraft with a single vacuum pump. Better avionics and equipment were made available as an option and can be IFR approved if equipped to 91 standards. In 1965, the PA-30B was introduced. This airframe featured room for six, and a third side window was added. The option list was also greatly expanded to include wingtip tanks, which gave an extra 30 gallons of fuel for a total of 120 gallons, and STCs were made available through Britton Industries to equip earlier models with tip tanks as well. But remember, these are early to mid-60s airplanes. While many of the remaining planes have been modified, there are still some aircraft out there with original panels still flying. According to the AOPA, some of the issues to be mindful of with the original panels are that most of the toggle switches are identical and can be easily misidentified. Moreover, many of those panels have a shotgun instrument layout. The altimeter is on the bottom left corner, and the DG is way up where the attitude indicator normally lies. Fortunately, many of the earlier models' shortcomings were addressed in 1968 with the introduction of the PA-30C. With it came a new panel and basic T instrument layout with new switches added and an added side panel for engines and magneto controls and repositioned circuit breakers from inside the throttle quadrant to the right panel. Thanks to some engine adjustments such as the addition of beefier valve guides and valves and better lubrication, the aircraft saw a few extra knots of cruise speed. Turbo normalized engines were also an option, and there's also an aftermarket option for a 200 horsepower Lycoming engine. In the early 1970s, the PA-30 became the PA-39 and featured counter-rotating propellers. Now this gives you the advantage of not having a critical engine and reducing the yaw moment in the event of an engine out situation, which for many light twins, losing the critical engine, the left engine, is a recipe for disaster. The PA-39 is also available with both normally aspirated and turbocharged engines. The turbo normalized engines are the IO320-C1As with the Ray J turbochargers. The turbo versions can be easily distinguished from normally aspirated engines, in part to the vents on the side of the engine nacelles. The Twin Comanche is also equipped with a dual 12-volt DC electrical system with 50-amp generator. The main tanks can hold 30 gallons per side, with aux tanks in the outboard wings at 15 gallons per side. And as I mentioned, the tip tanks add an additional 30 gallons. All in all, at a modest cruise setting, this is about a 5-hour airplane without tip tanks. All variants have 160 horsepower engines that are fuel injected and mated to a constant speed prop. Normally aspirated models have a gross weight of 3,600 pounds, and the turbo version's gross weight is 3,725 pounds. Useful load ranges from about 1,300 pounds to 1,393 pounds, with baggage capacity at about 250 pounds. Service ceiling ranges from 18,600 feet to flight level 250 for the turbo versions. Where the Twin Comanche falls short, though, is in cabin comfort. Inside, the cabin width is only 44 inches, and the height is only about 46. Ingress and egress is also difficult with its single cabin entrance door. It's also a bit of a challenge to handle. It lands a bit flat and hard if the speed and glide just aren't right. On the other hand, the Piper Seneca has been in production since 1971. It has withstood the test of time as one of the last remaining piston-powered twins still in production today. And it has seen a lot of changes and improvements over the years. It's a sixth-place light piston twin and basically the multi-engine version of the Cherokee 6. In fact, during initial testing, Piper placed two wing-mounted engines on a Cherokee 6, testing the prototype with a total of three engines. But the first prototype Seneca weren't Senecas at all. They were known as the Twin 6, which had a dual 0360 180 horsepower engine, later redesignated the PA-34-180. But the Seneca we all know today was first certified in 1971 and came standard with two 200 horsepower Lycoming IO-360 C1E6 engines. Actually, the right engine is the LIO-360, indicating a left-hand turning crankshaft, giving the airplane counter-rotating propellers. It's designated the Seneca 1, or more formally, the PA-34-200. It has a gross weight of about 4,000 pounds, with later models having a gross weight of 4,200 pounds. But the Seneca 1 had some handling issues, and Piper fought back by introducing the new and improved Seneca 2 in 1975. The new airplane was equipped with turbocharged engines, namely the TSIO-360E engines, producing 200 horsepower a side. Turbocharging gave the airplane better performance for takeoff and climbs, as well as high-altitude cruising. It's also allowed for another gross weight increase to 4,570 pounds. To tackle the handling complaints, Piper installed balanced ailerons, a stabilator, bob weight, and anti-servo tab to the elevator. The Seneca 2 also features some improvements to the cabin, namely an option for club seating. In 1981, another version of the Seneca was introduced, you guessed it, the Seneca 3. This time, engines were upgraded to 220 horsepower Continental TSIO-360-KB engines, which limited maximum horsepower output to 5 minutes. Now, the Seneca 3 is easily distinguished from earlier models thanks to its one-piece windscreen. Moreover, the instrument panel was also updated, and some later models featured a 28-volt electrical system and electric flaps. The increase in horsepower also brought another increase in gross weight, this time to 4,750 pounds. In 1994, minor improvements were made to the Seneca, giving birth to the Seneca 4. Most notably, improved cabin and cockpit layout and streamlined engine cowls for better performance. Finally, the Seneca 5 came to be in 1996 and is still in production today. The aircraft has an all-new cockpit design, including a number of switches relocated to an overhead panel. The engines were replaced with TSIO-360-RB engines, which feature an intercooler. Gross weight remains the same at 4,750 pounds, but thanks to added equipment, the aircraft's useful load is several hundred pounds less. The Seneca 5 also has the option for de-ice equipment and air conditioning, as well as flight instruments for the right seat. Depending on the year, you'll find Seneca 5s equipped with standard steam gauges, an Avidyne Integra package, or the Garmin G1000. Some of the other nice features of the Piper Seneca is its wide cabin entrance door and, of course, roomy cabin. The cabin is about 49 inches wide, 42 inches high, and just over 8 feet long. Later models have a service ceiling of 25,000 feet, burning about 23 to 24 gallons per hour at 75% power. They'll climb at about 1,400 feet per minute and cruise in the neighborhood of the high 180s, depending on power. With 128 gallons of fuel on later models, this gives you about a 5-hour endurance, or about 800 miles with reserves. Now, who is in the market for a piston twin? Better yet, who is best suited for a light twin? Well, if you've been flying complex singles for some time and you're ready to step up, a piston twin might be for you. You might even step up from a less complex airplane and go straight into a twin to build multi-engine time. Additionally, if you take your family or business associates on frequent short to medium range trips, you and your passengers will appreciate the added safety that two engines provide. Corporate operators and charter companies around the world have also found a lot of use from the Seneca. Either way, the light twin market is narrow, which is good for you because that means there's a disproportionate relationship between supply and demand, overall bringing prices down and making for good buys on both aircraft. So between the Twin Comanche and the Seneca, which is a better buy? Well, that answer really lies in what your mission is and what your overall objectives are. With anything in life, there are trade-offs, and when compared side by side, the Twin Comanche is quieter and more efficient than its Seneca counterpart. But the Seneca is roomier, more modern, and parts are fairly easy to come by for all variants. Now, Senecas also provide greater load-carrying capability and performance compared to the relatively underpowered Twin Comanche. Moreover, Twin Comanches are aging, and there are a limited number for sale. It probably goes without saying that a quality pre-buy is a must on either airplane, especially when it comes to engine and airframe corrosion and AD compliance. You definitely don't want any surprises during your first annual, which with a twin could cost you. Also, both aircraft types are commonly used in flight school, so you want to make sure that the aircraft didn't get too beat up. If you're still unsure which aircraft is best for you, it's a good idea to grab a copy of the POH to see the performance numbers for the ways you intend to fly and operate the aircraft. You can get a lot of these manuals for free on the internet, and it's also probably a good idea to fly both aircraft to see which one you are most comfortable with. Now, I put a side-by-side comparison chart for both airplanes in our Patreon page, which is linked into the show notes. So with that, Don's going to tell us more about the aircraft for sale.
Well, Adam, let's get down to business here. We got a lot of folks out there that want to buy a Twin Comanche or a Piper Seneca. Well, even if they don't have the money right now, I'm sure they're going to want to buy it in the future. So let's see what's out there for sale. Well, if you want a Piper Seneca, you have 60 to choose from. Yeah, quite a few to choose from. You know, okay, let's see. We got in Maryland a 1980 Seneca II, $110,000. Well, it's got 3,800 hours on the airframe and 800 hours since major overhaul. He says the paint and interior on a scale of 10 is a 5, so it probably needs some work. They only had one photograph of it on the controller, and so I couldn't see the end number to check to see maybe on my free site if it had any history to it. And so I'd have to order the FAA file to look up the airworthiness and registration file to see if it has any major repairs on it. But as a matter of fact, talking about the Seneca II and the 1981, yes, I was involved with one of them back in 1980. And if you're a Patreon member, you would find out because we had on a special edition for Patreon people all about this Seneca and the Seneca II. And also, we had some interesting information, safety tips on the Seneca in general. So the conversation goes on for quite a while. So not enough time to put it all in our show notes. But if you're a Patreon, it came right to you. And also, we talked about the different types of ADS-B. It's a confusing situation. There's so many out there, and people are advertising they have ADS-B, but that means, is it the kind that's not certified? I'm not sure, because sometimes they make the same part number in three different versions. So kind of got into that a little bit about ADS-B for the Patreon people. And we do appreciate it. Matter of fact, I think Adam mentioned we had some new ones that signed up for that today. That keeps us going. That's the juice that makes us work. Okay. We told you about that one. And, well, there's a bunch of them out there. The high price one is $1 million. And then there's some for $850,000. There's some for $550,000. And let's look at one for $275,000 in Arkansas. It's a 1997. It's only got, well, it's got 3,130 hours total time and 1,230 hours since major overhaul. And I believe they mean both engines, but they didn't say that. It's got the Garmin 530 WAS and the RDO 2000 radar. Yeah, that's an older radar. Skywatch 497. It's got all the logs and 337 files are in the controller, well, some of the logs anyway. So you could find this ad here for the 1997 in Arkansas with 3,130 hours. And there's a couple, I guess that's Trader Plane. Yeah, this one was in Trader Plane. There's a couple links there with PDF files. So if you want to read some notes about this airplane, because the 337 file, which they posted on a PDF file, it tells you about, gives you the STCs, supplemental type certificates, and there's a lot of them. You can improve this airplane, and instructions for continuous airworthiness limitations. It's very interesting reading, so I encourage you all to go find this airplane, even if you're not interested in it. At least you can find out a little bit about what's involved here with paperwork. Yep. Okay, then we have the Twin Comanche. In Colorado, there's a 1967 Turbo Twin Comanche, $69,500. It's got 6,011 hours total time airframe. The annual was done way back in 2015. Maybe it's been sitting on the ground a while, I don't know. It says the ADs are up to date, and it had a major gear inspection completed on the last annual. It looks to me like it's out of annual for a whole year now, but maybe there's something I don't know here. You'd have to call up the seller to find out. It's got pilot and co-pilot's STC on the shoulder harnesses and a JPI EDM 760 engine analyzer. The 6 and 7 seats have been removed but are available. It's got Sky Oxygen Osborne tip tanks. Yep, those. They don't all have those tip tanks on the wings. And it has a bunch of maintenance items here it had done. Yeah, okay, so that's that one. The engines, okay. The engines have, the left side has 722 hours and the right has 279 hours since major overhaul. You know, these times look pretty good. The plane's 69,500, but I wonder what else about it, because we'd have to do a file search and read the logbooks to find out. Well, then in Mississippi, there's another 1967, a 260 Comanche for 82,000. And that also has some pages of the logbooks in a PDF file in Trader Plane there. So that'd be worth looking at. It has 5,892 hours on the airframe and 105 hours since major overhaul. Now, they don't say both engines, so I'm not sure about that. So I'm reading between the lines. Just because they say 105 hours since major overhaul, I don't know. Maybe it's just one engine, the other one's run out. But it seems pretty reasonable for two low-time engines. And the prop was overhauled 105 hours ago, too. One prop. It doesn't say the other prop, what happened there. Okay. It's got a STEC 50 autopilot with altitude hold and coupled to GPS. It's got a Garmin GPS 400, the older KMA audio panel, and the older transponder, the KT-76 transponder. And let's see what else it's got here of interest. It's the backup radio is the King 197A common transmitter and receiver, so that's good. And then it's got the old ADF 87 in it, and it's got the old KNS 80 RNAV in it, and the older Storm Scope, the 10A Storm Scope, and it has the EMD 700 engine analyzer. Okay, that's good. Oh, okay, it's got some additional equipment on it. He says that it's got the STC Eagle XP speed cowlings, which cost $12,000. And all speed gap mods, okay. It's got electric trim, rudder trim, alternate air source, alternate vacuum system, toe brakes and hand brakes. I guess he means on both sides. I don't know. It's got a digital clock and factory reserve 90-gallon fuel, true airspeed indicator. Yeah, well, yeah, okay. So let's see. Refurbished in 2008 on paint and the interior anyway. I don't know about the paint. And said it's got a fresh annual. Okay, but 105 hours ago, it did have a gear up landing. So we have to look into that. Okay, so those are the airplanes. Oh, let's see. Yep, those are the airplanes we're covering this episode. And we have a lot more things going on this episode, so we're going to make it short. So don't forget, if you pick out one of these airplanes or any airplane, give us a call for a free 30-minute consultation, and we'll talk about the ones you picked out, and we'll send us a link ahead of time. Actually, it's best to send me a text message ahead of time, and then I'll call you back at the most convenient time for you. That's 910-528-7769, and I'm Don.
You've got mail.
Yes, we do. And the first bit of mail comes to us from Rob, who actually wrote us a little while back. He said, I recently found your podcast and have learned a lot. The format flows smoothly and the information is presented in a readily understandable format for us non-mechanics. I used to own a Cherokee 180 and wish I knew about you before I purchased the plane. When I purchased the airplane, I did so based on the recommendation from the mechanic who had been maintaining it for the last 4 years. While he was familiar with the plane, I found that there were several maintenance items that were not performed. Regardless, I have learned that when and if I purchase a plane, an independent mechanic will be consulted. Well, Rob, thanks for that feedback, and that is an excellent point. A lot of times people get talked into doing an annual with the seller's mechanic, and the problem is there's no one there representing you during that process, and it's pretty likely that there's going to be some things that come up that you're not even going to be aware of, or maybe the mechanic isn't even aware of. And as soon as you buy the airplane, all that stuff becomes your problem. So it's always a good idea to get at least a second set of eyes on the airplane before you buy it. Rob continues and asks, do you have any experience with owner-assisted annuals? And that is not something that I personally have experience with or done, and we don't offer that service. So I recommended Rob go talk to some of the type clubs for the airplanes that he is interested in, because a lot of the time they are a great resource for all sorts of technical information, including owner-assisted annuals. So anyway, I hope that helps, Rob, and thanks again for writing in. The next bit of feedback comes to us from Evan, who says, I love the podcast. It's incredibly informative, yet easy to listen to. I'd like to hear about TBMs sometime if you perform an inspection or just some general thoughts. Well, Evan, thanks for the suggestion. That's a great idea. It's a really cool airplane, and we would love to talk about it. We're actually going to do a show on single-engine turboprops in general, kind of comparing the TBM and a couple of the other small single-engine turboprops out there. So look forward to that here in the coming weeks. And our next bit of feedback comes to us from Jack, who says, I love the podcast. Just on the first episode, though, I wonder if you guys might want to talk about this kind of situation and others like it. And what he did is he sent us a link to a forum that has a Piper Seneca in pieces on a truck in one picture, and then for sale on controller in another picture. And I mentioned this before, and you know, it's really there to kind of reinforce the need for a pre-buy, because that is something that we would want to know about before we buy the airplane, and something that we will find out about before you buy the airplane, of course. So Don, you want to talk a little bit more about this situation?
Well, we got some feedback a while back, and this is an appropriate time to bring it up, because it was about a Piper Seneca. And one of our listeners sent us a picture of a Piper Seneca, November 275 Juliet Mike, and it was completely wrecked on a trailer being towed away. And then it was advertised for sale in the controller. Well, it's not there anymore, listener. It's somebody bought it, and it was in pieces when it was wrecked in 2007. Who knows? Maybe it's a good airplane now. Maybe not. Well, that's why we like to search the FAA files, the airworthiness file, and the registration file, because that airworthiness file have the 337 reports of major repairs, and this was definitely a major repair. And if it doesn't have it there, we've got a problem. So we can't, but probably it is, and probably somebody fixed it okay. But you know, if we did a pre-buy in that airplane, it would be extensive. So that's the mystery airplane. And since you since our follower last reported it, we had to hold off till we get to twin engine airplanes and Senecas. So I hope it doesn't pop up again, but if it does, we talked about it.
That's right, Don. You heard it here first. And our next bit of feedback comes from a different Evan, who says, "Hi, I was hoping to get your thoughts on a subject. I'm new to general aviation and in the process of getting my private license. Naturally, I look down the road towards purchasing my own plane at some point. I wonder what your thoughts are on experimental aircraft as a first plane. I ask because they seem to be substantially cheaper with more modern avionics. However, there's also that nagging feeling of buying an airplane that someone put together with no real idea of how well. But you can get relatively cheap Lancairs and Glassairs, etc., with great characteristics. In any case, would love to hear your thoughts. I love the podcast so far. More info on your hour than me scouring the internet for days. Keep it up." Well, Evan, thanks a lot, and I'm going to let Don take the lead on this question, and I'll kind of fill in some gaps here as we go along.
Lately, we've been having requests for experimental airplanes and what we think about them. So in order to serve our listeners better, I thought we might get off topic, even though we're not going to be covering airplanes, single engine lands, for another 3 weeks. But for right now, because of our listeners' requests, we're going to talk a little bit about experimental airplanes, what they're not and what they could be, because experience is the best teacher. And so we inspect all kinds of airplanes, and when I get to an experimental airplane, I'm thinking of a certificated airplane. So I usually have to ask the builder or owner certain questions, and then he could say to me, "Well, this is the way it's supposed to be built, and here's the instructions." And then I say, "Good, good job." But I need to also look at the shop heads that are rivets and any welding that had to be done and all kinds of things that are hardware and all kinds of things that are different about experimental airplane, because basically I'm looking for inferior work or something that would cause a problem in the future. I could see the reason why a person would get involved with an experimental airplane. It's a task, but there's great pride of accomplishment in building it, or even helping to assemble it, and the cost of operating is less. It's a newer airplane than a certified airplane. But I asked the questions: will it hold its value like a Cessna or a Piper? So if you folks have answers for these questions, give us some feedback. The next question: is the airplane versatile for your needs? The next question: is the airplane safe? That's important. So that's part of the pre-buy. And the next question: will the airplane deteriorate with age? This is another consideration. You might wind up keeping this airplane a long time. And then I'd like to know if anybody has the answer. I remember a while back it was a very high percentage, but if anybody has the answer, give us some feedback. And how many projects for building experimental aircraft are abandoned and never get built, and sometimes sold in the partially complete condition? And then, what is the final cost when you're all done and ready to fly? How much you got into it? Well, of course, this isn't counting your labor hours, which might be a whole year of work So I look at it this way, unless you're having fun, a year of work, you could buy just about buy a single engine land airplane for that kind of money you can make working for a year. When you buy an experimental aircraft, I think in most cases, the labor hours to build it is lost when you resell it. You know, hopefully you're getting back just the money you put into it and doesn't count your labor. But if somebody has some more feedback on that, we'd like to know it.
Yeah, that's right, Don. And I think it's fair to say that experimental airplanes aren't necessarily our forte, but we've helped a few people with some experimental airplanes recently. And I can tell you that it's true. You can get a lot of airplane for your money with an experimental, a newer airplane, a higher performance airplane, better avionics, and so on and so forth. And you might be under the impression that you're not necessarily responsible for all the FAA requirements that go along with a certified airplane, and to an extent that's true. So something to consider, whether you are buying a completed airplane or you're looking to buy and build your own, the thing to think about though is that the FAA isn't really the end-all be-all like it is with certified airplanes. The manufacturer is. So if the manufacturer has maintenance items in the manual, you have to comply with them. If they have inspections in the manual, you have to comply with them. And so those are some things you're going to want to think about as far as costs in the long run that you may not otherwise encounter with a certified airplane, because certified airplane maintenance is fairly predictable and it is very clear as to what is required and what is not. And that's not always the case with experimental airplanes. The other thing to think about is how and who is going to maintain the airplane, because a lot of the time mechanics aren't very well versed in experimental airplanes. So you're gonna have to get with the type clubs for experimental airplanes and with the EAA to figure out who can maintain the airplane, what shops, etc., what parts they're using, and all that fun stuff. I would say another consideration is insurance. I know for a fact that insurance on an experimental airplane is significantly higher than it is on a certified airplane, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 times as much, maybe more. It all depends on the plane and the pilot, of course. But anyway, that's another consideration to be thinking about when doing your due diligence on researching airplanes. And finally, something that we've come across recently, a lot actually, is looking into experimental airplanes. And a lot of the time, they have to do their own performance flight tests to get some of their performance figures. And as a result, a lot of planes get crashed or damaged in the process. For example, we were recently helping a customer look into a experimental airplane, and I figured out pretty quickly that the airplane had been involved in 2 prop strikes as a result of doing a gross weight landing, and the airplane lost control and ran off the runway. And long story short, the documentation just wasn't there, and the processes and materials used just weren't there to say, hey, this is a safe airplane to buy. So that's something else to consider. So, you know, you think about it, yeah, you get a lot of airplane for the money with an experimental, but you might make up for it by buying a airplane that you can't resell or an airplane that is unsafe, not to mention the increased cost with some of the maintenance issues and items as well as insurance. So those are the things you really need to think about when looking into an experimental airplane. And I hope that kind of clears some of that up. So anyway, thanks for all you guys who have sent us questions this week and in the past couple weeks. We do appreciate it. We've been getting a lot of questions about experimentals, which is why we wanted to kind of spend a few minutes to talk about it. One more thing before we move on to the next segment, the tip of the week. We did get another iTunes rating and review about a week ago. It's from QA Damon, and it says it's a 5-star rating, and it says, incredibly useful podcast. So many fantastic details, but explained well enough that us laymen can understand it. I really love the after show format. You can hear some of the same information in a couple different ways to help explain it, which really helps it stick. Well, we really appreciate your rating and review. Thank you so much. And we hope that we can continue to serve you well. And hey, Don, he likes the after show, so we're going to keep doing that format for as long as you can handle it. And also, guys, if you want to leave us a rating or review, I just posted a new video on our social media pages and in Patreon, as well as the show notes for this video, that shows you exactly step by step how to do it, not just for our show, but any of your favorite aviation podcasts, which I really encourage you to do because it helps other people find the show just a little bit easier. And of course, it motivates us to keep going. So anyway, with that, let's move on to the next part of the show.
It's time for the tip of the week.
My tip of the episode is geared towards you folks who want to buy a twin Comanche. Yes, the twin Comanche has an STC for the nose cowl, and it's quite interesting. If you want to go 5 knots faster, this might be for you, because this newly designed cowling, it's kind of complicated in how to put it on. It just isn't a bolt-on. You have to do some modifications. So I have enclosed under the tip of the episode a nice video showing you all about this newly designed cowling, which is supposed to give the engine better cooling and supposed to give your airspeed a little boost. So look at the show notes and click on the video.
Yep, that's right. And you can access that video by going to airplaneintelpodcast.com, and it's under the section that says Tip of the Week, and it's a big video. You can't miss it. You can also access it directly from your smartphone and mobile device by clicking the link in your podcast player that says Access Full Show Notes Here. So with that, guys, we're going to wrap up. I'm going to take off. Don's going to stick around for another after show. He's going to tell us some cool stories about the Seneca, which I know you're going to want to check out. We are going to be covering turboprops in episode 26 next week, but I'm not sure just yet which one that's going to be, so you're going to have to just hang on tight and stick with us and find out next time. We do appreciate you hanging out with us and listening and being here with us, and you really are making this podcast really fun, and we do appreciate it. Don't forget to check out our Patreon page and to visit us on Facebook and Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. You can also send us an email, feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. So anyway, with that, guys, thanks again for being here, and stay safe, everyone. Are you still here? The conversation continues at the after show, starting right now.
Well, we're back. At least I'm back. And I'm going to talk a little more about this PA-34 Piper Seneca. I mentioned here in the introduction, I have a pretty big involvement in this airplane, this make and model anyway. Yeah, it's going to go back here now like 37 years. Yeah, a long time ago. I was working at the local airport doing everything, being an aircraft mechanic, an aircraft salesman, a flight instructor, and a pilot service pilot. And the customers really liked me. They were buying airplanes off me at list price just to get all the services I was performing. And I would make sure that the red carpet was out, the tanks were full, and I was ready to serve them as a pilot if they needed it. So anyway, one of my customers bought a brand new 1980 Seneca, turbocharged, of course. And anyway, the first thing I found out was test flying the airplane, even though it was brand new, I wanted to get all the warranty we could, so he didn't have any trouble operating that airplane in the future. So I went up to high altitudes and noticed the airplane was missing a beat. The engines were kind of not running right at high altitude. So a little investigation and a lot of time found out that because the magnetos weren't pressurized, the airplane didn't run right in the thin air. So I was told, well, you know, you could retard the spark a little bit. Wait a minute. I'm an aircraft mechanic. I don't do it unless the book tells me to do it. I have no authority to change the timing on the engine. So it wound up that the fix was to pressurize the magnetos. And so that cured it. So customer buys the airplane and I get him checked out, get his multi-engine rating and everything, gets his fresh instrument rating, and wants to go from North Carolina to California. Can't remember where. I think it was San Jose. But anyway, he wants to fly there. And he was a little weary about instrument flying. I said, okay, I'll go with you. So we jump in the plane and fly all the way to California, stay overnight. He goes to his meeting, and then we come back. Well, don't you know there wasn't a cloud in the sky? Oh, well. And boy, was I sore from sitting in that airplane for 2 days. So then the customer says, you know, Don, he says, I want an angle of attack indicator. I said, you do? Okay, I can't make it, but I'll get it made for you. Because back then, you know, back in 1980s, that was like, you know, in jets and jet fighters. It wasn't in general aviation airplanes, small ones like this one. So I went to Raleigh Flying Service at Raleigh Durham Airport and said, hey, I got a deal for you. If you work with me, get an STC, Supplemental Type Certificate, for an angle of attack system in this particular PA-34 220T, Seneca 2. I said, you can keep the STC and we'll keep the airplane. It will be legal. And he said, well, that's a good deal. You just fly it and pay for your own fuel and we'll put our avionics technician in and we'll do all the work. So I had to pay for the equipment, the angle of attack indicator in this system. And they installed it and we test flew the airplane and he got his angle of attack indicator. The only one out there. And maybe up till today, it might still be the only one out there. I'm not sure. But anyway, then things got kind of wild. The airplane was sold, and the airplane was used on a trip. Anyway, what happened is the airplane crashed. And it was kind of beyond my control or anybody else's control. It was pilot error. So I found out during my investigation of the accident, and the FAA agreed with me, that the magneto switches, there's like a gang bar of rocker switches, nice white switches, they go on and off. And they're to the left arm of the pilot on a console. And right below it, there's another console with the same color switches, and they all do different functions, but they're not the magneto switches. So to protect the magneto switches from being accidentally turned off with your elbow or something, you know, with your left elbow, they put a plastic guard that spring-loaded that flips up, and that's supposed to protect them. So the pilot was taking off in a mountainous area, and he just got airborne. And somehow, I think you could only do it this way because I tried it, and the only way I could turn those magneto switches off is to put my right hand over my left arm, and it's nighttime. And obviously he did it by feel. And what I found out is that plastic guard felt like the edge of the landing light switches directly below it in the other console. And he obviously thought that that was the landing light switches. And if you had your arm up high enough, you could feel the plastic guard thinking it was the end of the console panel, and you could flip off the magnetos of the left engine. And because the landing lights were right underneath that position. So that's what happened. And the airplane went out of control, wasn't handled properly, and crashed. So that's my story of the Seneca 2. So if you're interested in buying a Seneca, you know, we can help you out there. We can check all the latest improvements and make sure you get a good airplane. So till next week, next episode, have a good week.
Thanks for listening to the Airplane Intel Podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope that you'll subscribe to the show and follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Pre-Buy Guys. To access show notes, archives, and other free resources, head on over to AirplaneIntelPodcast.com. To get answers to your questions, drop us a line on social media or send an email to feedback@AirplaneIntelPodcast.com. You can also reach us by phone at 904-290-3870. And remember, owning an airplane doesn't have to be hazardous to your wealth.